Welcome to the Architectural History Podcast, a podcast dealing with histories of architecture in the built environment. In our first series, Architecture And, we speak to a number of academics, architects, writers and thinkers to discuss space, buildings and cities, and to think through contemporary debates and issues.
Hello, Jess.
Hi, Matt.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. We're back again with this, which is going to be the final episode in this series of the SAHGB podcast. You organised the guests for this one. So do you want to tell us what we're going to be talking about and who came along to join us?
Absolutely. Yes, it feels quite momentous to have reached the end of our series and our final episode. And we're finishing on the topic of architecture and city living. So we wanted to think about different ways that people have lived in cities. So we're focusing on London, but I feel like a lot of what we've talked about has a resonance and a relevance beyond the capital. But each of our contributors have looked at a different example of urban architecture from the 20th century, and they've thought specifically about how it's been used by people in communities. So that relationship between the buildings and the lives of people. So we reflect on, I think, what architectural history can contribute to an understanding of cities and how people have lived in them and how we live in them now. We had three people come and talk to us. We had John Boughton, who is a social historian, whose book, Municipal Dreams, The Rise and Fall of Council Housing, was published in 2018. And it's based on his very popular blog with the same name, which charts the history of council estates up and down the country. And he's talking about a specific case study of the Pepys estate in Deptford. We also had Alistair Cartwright, who's an architectural historian, who's recently a postdoctoral fellow of the Paul Mellon Centre, who is working on the history of rented housing after the Second World War. And finally, Anne Harrig Davis, who's an artist, writer and researcher. She works for Critical Design Practice and Public Works. And in her most recent projects, she's been a researcher for the feminist design collective Matrix, so working as a project manager at the Woolworth Garden, which is the case study that she's talking about where Matrix designed a building.
Amazing. So we've got a kind of range of speakers talking about housing and London and community from the end of the First World War right up until the sort of end of the 20th century and to the modern day.
Absolutely.
So I guess without further ado, we'll hear from John.
Tell us about Municipal Dreams, which is both a blog and a book now. Where did the idea come from?
In terms of Municipal Dreams, the blog, it began in 2013 and it emerged from my PhD back in the day and my sort of political and academic interest in labour and working class politics. And specifically, back in 2013, I was walking along Old Bethnal Green Road in East London and I was just very struck by the range of local authority provision, schools, health centres, libraries, but most of all, of course, housing, council housing. And we must remember in 1981, one in three of the population lived in a council home. So it's been a huge part of our shared social history. And when you come to council housing, it's been well covered by some academics. But to me, it's been strangely neglected in mainstream history and a lot of local histories.
So you've written specifically about the Pepys estate in Lewisham, which was built in 1966, I think. And you described the story of that estate, that single estate, as sort of representative of the narrative of inner city council housing over the last 50 years. So what was special or significant about the Pepys estate when it was built back in the 60s?
Well, it was officially opened in 1966 by Lord Mountbatten, no less. That was a tribute to the naval heritage of the former Admiralty dockyards on which it was situated. But actually not completed until 1973. But as you suggest, I do think it's representative of a broader history, but also quite special in its own way. So, of course, when it was opened, it was a Greater London Council scheme at a time when the GLC had found its housing responsibilities diminished from those of the London County Council. So it's an important and quite a large-scale project for them. And it was a showpiece. And to give you some indication of that, you know, the quotation of an early resident is that people were fighting to move on to the estate, and the lucky ones felt privileged. They were proud to be part of a showcase, spotlessly clean and well looked after. So that was in the early 70s, By 1979, you can go to the local press. It's a one-word headline in a press article, Nightmare. And the article goes on to describe the estate as littered with abandoned cars, graffiti splatters the walls, garages are deserted because people fear to use them, and piles of rubbish clog waste disposal units. Now, whether that was a fair or accurate representation is a larger question, but nevertheless, in terms of perception and representation, it gives you a good impression of a lot of the kind of coverage and maybe to some degree the experience of council estates by the later 70s into the 1980s. And then thirdly, in terms of its representativeness, I think we're looking at what happens in the 80s and 90s, which is, of course, regeneration. And that in the Pepys estate, as elsewhere, was typically a drawn out and very controversial process.
So how did housing policy and the changing economic contexts impact on the estate and perceptions of its design?
Well, as I said, to begin with, the GLC showpiece, and just to give you some indication of its size and scale, it was a 45-acre site, 1,500 homes, a population of around 5,000 people. 10 interconnected eight-story blocks, 324-story tower blocks, as well as some low-rise housing and some rehabilitated 18th and 19th century naval buildings. And, you know, one thing that was significant about it, I think, was that this was a riverside setting formerly closed off to the local working class, although they lived and worked on the docks, of course, but made available to working class residents, which is perhaps not so frequent nowadays. So I think in terms of the significance of the estate in its early days, it was kind of in a way quite typical of a lot of the kind of planning ideas and ideals of the day. And that meant, of course, mixed development, a range of housing to suit a range of life stages. It included a lot of community provision, a tenants' club room, an old people's club room, a youth club, a health centre, open space and play areas, all those kind of essentials of a civilised neighbourhood and community. So at the time when it was built, it housed a generally better off working class. Actually, its rents were slightly higher than average, £5 to £8 a week at the time. And it was an overwhelmingly white working class. And actually, the GLC operated an informal, but what we would now understand as a very racist allocations policy. The Pepys estate was allocated to white residents, whereas black families were by and large allocated to the Milton Court estate, not too far away. But that was, I think, well-intentioned, but obviously something we'd find pretty reprehensible.
So how do you think housing policy and changing economic contexts impacted on the estate?
Well, one of the big changes that takes place in the late 70s is a change in allocations policy. And of course, you get this general move to needs-based assessment in terms of prioritising those in greatest need and in most need of council housing. And another aspect of that, of course, was the 1977 Housing Homeless Persons Act, which gave a statutory right to council housing for those designated as in priority need, typically those with certain health needs or families and young children. So that change in allocations policy, obviously entirely benign and well-meaning, has perhaps unintended consequences in the 1980s at a time when under the Thatcher government, new council house building is being virtually halted. And of course, many homes are being lost to right to buy. So you get this process of what the sociologists call residualization. And there's some very interesting kind of observations of this process occurring in the eyes of local residents, in their words. When they moved the problem families in, that's when you got a lot of trouble. They started with just one block, now it's all around the estate. And another resident said, it's like this estate is the end of the road, the toilet of society, and we get all the dregs. A place is only as good as the people who live there. Now, that might have been pretty harsh to most of the new residents, but it reflected a fairly widespread perception of a changing demographic on the estate, certainly so far as older residents were concerned. And of course, in the Pepys context, as you might understand, that gets mixed up with racism because, you know, a large number of black families, black and ethnic minority families are being housed on the estate. Typically, they were those in greatest housing need at the time. And so you do get quite a lot of racism on the estate and some fairly unpleasant behaviour as a result. So by the early 1980s, the estate is seen as a problem estate. Quite high crime rates, there's a sort of epidemic of skag, which was a very kind of cheap form of heroin. And at the same time, of course, you get this, in the context of sort of 1980s deindustrialization, a real decline of traditional local employment. 13% male unemployment on the state, up to 50% youth unemployment. So all of that, of course, has major consequences on the estate and its community. Now, what I think is interesting is that rather than examining and holding that context to account from the 70s into the 80s, influential thinkers are blaming the design of council estates. And so the irony is that those walkways, for example, which residents perceived as a friendly meeting place, became identified as creating a lack of defensible space. They became not an asset to the estate, but perceived as a major problem. And that's perhaps one of the first things that changes attitude towards the estate and its design and informs its later regeneration.
So what were the controversies that were surrounding that regeneration of the estate?
Well, I think in the first years, and we're talking about a sort of long process of various kind of iterations, but I think in the early years, regeneration was relatively uncontroversial. It began in the 1980s with the so-called Safe Neighbourhoods Estate Action Programme. And at that point, you simply had kind of entry phone systems, which were entirely praiseworthy. You had some renovation of the eight-storey blocks. You know, those represented an improvement to the housing and to the experience of it. By 1992, you've got a further kind of stage in this process in the city challenge element of regeneration. One of the larger blocks was demolished, and it was replaced by 18 3-4 bed houses and gardens. So typically, of course, by this stage, you're looking at this criticism of multi-story living, modernist design, and this return to traditional housing, as it were. And then the big change really occurs in 1999, and this is stock transfer. So this was very much part of a widespread process at the time, willed by both the Conservative and actually even more so by New Labour, the large-scale so-called voluntary transfer of council estates, council housing, to typically housing associations. And in 1999, the Pepys estate is transferred to the Hyde Housing Association. And what they do is they demolish five of the estate's low-rise blocks, although in fact four of them had been renovated under previous regeneration, and those were replaced by a mixed tenure scheme. Now, interestingly, of those blocks that were demolished, four of them were close to the river. So these were the most attractive to incomers, those on shared ownership schemes, etc. So already a degree of class bias, perhaps, in terms of how council tenants and incoming owner-occupiers were being treated. And then most powerfully and most tellingly, in 2002, one of the 24 story blocks, Aragon Tower, that's the one that was right next to the river, was sold to Barclay Homes. It was sold for 11.5 million. Barclay Homes added five floors to it, created 14 penthouse suites. And at the same time, of course, 144 council flats were lost to the housing stock. And this was a really kind of powerful and I think quite kind of egregious illustration of the sort of new political and planning ideas of the day. Some of them are benign in sound. So, for example, mixed communities, this criticism of sort of monoclass, monolithic council estates, but a prejudice against sort of working class housing, which wasn't applied to similarly monolithic middle class suburbs, for example. But what you see underlying all this is a withdrawal of direct public investment in that process of stock transfer and in that using public-private partnership and cross-subsidy. So rather than funding social housing directly and efficiently through the public purse, of course, we're now in partnership with private developers and fairly entrepreneurial housing associations who, of course, have their own agenda. And that agenda isn't primarily providing social housing for those in greatest need. And to conclude, and the bottom line, is that the whole process of regeneration on the Pepys estate led to the loss of 366 secure council tenancies. So I think in that sense, its regeneration was typical and regrettable.
Wow. So, yeah, that was such an amazing deep dive into the history of a single estate, but the way that it reflects these broader trends and changes in the history of housing, and particularly state-led council housing over the course of the last 70 years. I got to recommend to listeners, if you haven't either checked out John's blog, Municipal Dreams, or bought his book, they are immaculate and expansive kind of examinations of the forces at work, both socially and politically, in British housing over the last, since the end of the war, and before indeed. So strongly, strongly recommend that. Who are we hearing from next, Jess?
So next I talked to Alistair Cartwright, who is talking about rented accommodation in London after the war, and then into what it can tell us about recent history. So most of your recent work, Alistair, has been about London after the Second World War. Can you tell us how you became interested in the architecture of what you've called rented rooms?
I mean, the phrase rented rooms is totally commonplace in the 20 or so years after the Second World War. And I'm sure people will have friends or family who remember that phrase, you know, applied to bedsits and boarding houses and small flats, flatlets. But, you know, anyone scanning through the back pages of a newspaper or a newsagent's windows looking for a place to live would have been familiar with that. It is the generic term describing the vast array of different kinds of private rented housing. And yeah, it's kind of astonishing that, you know, when we think of the post-war period, we, of course, think of the social housing that was built, the tremendous efforts that were made, also the rise of owner occupancy, particularly amongst working class people. But less has been said really about private rented housing. And yet, for most people in big cities, this is what the kind of housing people were living in until the early 60s. So I was really interested in delving into that world. I guess you could think of it as the shadow to these other forms of housing and the whole redevelopment of the city in the post-war period. It's the shadow in the sense that, you know, a shadow is tied to its object, is cast by it. Sometimes these forms of private rented housing were quite literally in the shadow of towering new office blocks or high-rise housing. They were seen increasingly as a kind of residuum, a leftover of the new, of the modern. But they were also, as the kind of other of these spaces, kind of necessary to it, really, practically and symbolically, I think, in the sense that, you know, where commercial developers during the property boom of the second half of the 1950s were looking for land that they could redevelop, it was land on which this kind of housing sat, subdivided terraced housing, mostly vast amounts of it. And it was potentially hugely profitable. But it was also symbolically, I guess, the shadow of the new, of the modern in the post-war period, in that the very idea of a domestic ideal, of a new domestic ideal in the post-war period, was constructed in opposition to this kind of housing, which was seen as, you know, the unhomely, the unideal. And that's a term that I explore with reference to a very interesting series of fire safety displays that the LCC did at this exhibition called the Ideal Home Exhibition, which people may know because it's still running. Yeah, looking at these fire safety displays, you see how the subdivided terraced house, a private rented housing, particularly the multiple occupancy home, is constructed as the other to the homely ideals of the day. And they're these fascinating, quite disturbing exhibitions because on the one hand, they're about publicising the terrible conditions in this kind of housing and putting pressure on landlords to deal with it, as well as offering safety advice. But they're also incredibly fantastical and somewhat voyeuristic, and they hark back to images of the bomb site or the ruined buildings that littered London after the Second World War, with these kind of blown out interiors, these kind of dark, almost baroque spaces.
So you talk about how these rented rooms in post-war London were, or were certainly perceived to be, the setting of social problems. What kind of problems were they?
Yeah, they were seen as the places where all kinds of social problems kind of concentrated. So problems like the idea of delinquent youth and its links to so-called problem families. This is essentially a kind of pathologization of larger working class families, and it being linked to a rising kind of crime wave in the early 50s. Two particular problems I focus on, which almost seem like opposites in a way, but are connected in interesting ways, are the problem of isolation and loneliness on the one hand and the problem of overcrowding on the other. You know, both of these, I mean, I think like all the so-called social problems of the post-war period that are seen to concentrate in private rented housing, these hark back to issues of the 19th century. And, you know, when we're talking about isolation, in a way, it's the kind of universal trope of atomization that, you know, big city living brings about. But these rented rooms become particularly perceived as problematic with the issue of overcrowding that I mentioned. I think what's interesting in the post-war period is this becomes racialized. It becomes linked to immigration. So you have in 1954 a pamphlet put out by the Commonwealth, the Conservative Commonwealth Association, which talks about a quote, new Harlem taking root in dilapidated areas of the inner city, where rooms in large dilapidated houses are sublet at high rentals, quote, to coloured immigrants in conditions of utmost squalor. I mean, the racist language is on the surface. It's not hidden. But what's interesting is at the same time, there's this strong desire from the government to, on the international stage, to hold the Commonwealth together. And of course, there's the open door immigration policy from the end of the Second World War to meet Britain's labour needs. So this tying of immigration to the housing crisis, I mean, an old tactic, well, a familiar tactic by now, but it could be said to originate then, is counterbalanced with other priorities. There's this attempt by the government in the mid-50s to link immigration to the housing crisis in a way that has become a now familiar trope, you know, with the hostile environment and the right to rent policy nowadays. But I think what's interesting in the post-war period is that race is kind of defined in terms of domestic culture, in terms of the way that people live in their homes and the different habits that people display. That is partly how otherness is constructed at this time. And that has to do with the kind of tarnishing or waning of certain older ideas of biological racism. And it's a kind of new cultural presentation of those ideas. So the space of the home becomes incredibly charged and racialized, really. And you see that in all kinds of novels and popular films at the time. I think a particularly fascinating example is the film Flame in the Streets, which was adapted from a play by Ted Willis called Hot Summer Night. And in many ways, it's quite a serious attempt to confront racism in British society. And it comes broadly from the left. But you have these fascinating shots of the main character wandering through a house that's let out in rooms in the darkened interior. But then as she enters into each room kind of reveals a whole world in itself, with a family living in there, with all kinds of activities going on, with music being played, with a baby being changed. It's an exoticization of the kind of life that was imagined unfolding in those rooms. I think it also turns the room into a whole world in which, you know, it actually, partly against its own wishes, reveals the ways that people really made a life in these rooms and adapted the space, using furniture, using partitions of their own to hold all kinds of activities that were essential to them.
Which I think that links to the next question of thinking about how at the same time as being spaces of social problems, these rented rooms also became spaces of resistance.
Yeah, there is a tendency to see the building of social housing after the Second World War as if it was kind of a done deal. You know, I think what's really important to recognise is that the struggle for housing, the battle for homes, as one pamphlet at the time put it, was ongoing. It was a continuous contest. And that battle was really waged actually mostly in the private rented sector. The pressure came from there. And I mean, that makes sense, and that's where the most terrible housing conditions were. And I trace that resistance from the 1946 mass squatting movement, in which tens of thousands of people took over empty army bases, and in London took over luxury service flats and hotels in these mass occupations. From there to the early 60s with the eruption of the Rackman scandal around the slum landlord Peter Rackman, and the way that tenants' associations had been building up from the mid-50s, exposing landlords winning reductions in rent. And particularly the key moment was the 1957 Rent Act and the resistance that was organized in response to that. And yeah, I guess what I'm partly interested in is just remembering that all this stuff happened, but also articulating the link between the institutions of the welfare state and these grassroots struggles.
So the final question is, do you see parallels between this history and the situation we see today with evictions on the rise and the experience of the pandemic in terms of overcrowding and other housing issues?
Yeah, I think there are some parallels, really. I mean, I guess this is, you know, a crisis moment that we're living through. I mean, it's not on the scale of the Second World War, but it's possibly the biggest kind of crisis since then. And it's drawn kind of nostalgic comparisons with that time, you know, with the evocation of the Blitz spirit and so on. But I think aside from that, those nostalgic comparisons, there are real ones, you know, because I think what this crisis has done is to show, you know, when the government says to shelter at home, you know, it shows what a home really is, which is a place of shelter that is essential to health. So it, rather than something that's for profit. So it kind of exposes that. It reveals what a home is really worth or should be worth. The poor housing conditions and overcrowding that still persist today have been linked explicitly to increased rates of COVID. So those problems that were already there have been exacerbated by this pandemic, which has not been the kind of great leveler that some people talked about at the beginning, but the great exposer of issues that were already there. Although those changes like the eviction ban have been rolled back now, I don't think those lessons are so easily forgotten. And I think that's fascinating.
So most of your recent work, Alistair, has been about London after the Second World War. Can you tell us how you became interested in the architecture of what you've called rented rooms?
I mean, the phrase rented rooms is totally commonplace in the 20 or so years after the Second World War. And I'm sure people will have friends or family who remember that phrase, you know, applied to bedsits and boarding houses and small flats, flatlets. But, you know, anyone scanning through the back pages of a newspaper or a newsagent's windows looking for a place to live would have been familiar with that. It is the generic term describing the vast array of different kinds of private rented housing. And yeah, it's kind of astonishing that, you know, when we think of the post-war period, we of course think of the social housing that was built, the tremendous efforts that were made, also the rise of owner occupancy, particularly amongst working class people. But less has been said really about private rented housing. And yet, for most people in big cities, this is what the kind of housing people were living in until the early 60s. So I was really interested in delving into that world. I guess you could think of it as the shadow to these other forms of housing and the whole redevelopment of the city in the post-war period. It's the shadow in the sense that, you know, a shadow is tied to its object, is cast by it. Sometimes these forms of private rented housing were quite literally in the shadow of towering new office blocks or high-rise housing. They were seen increasingly as a kind of residuum, a leftover of the new, of the modern. But they were also, as the kind of other of these spaces, kind of necessary to it, really, practically and symbolically, I think. In the sense that, you know, where commercial developers during the property boom of the second half of the 1950s were looking for land that they could redevelop, it was land on which this kind of housing sat, subdivided terraced housing, mostly vast amounts of it. And it was potentially hugely profitable. But it was also symbolically, I guess, the shadow of the new, of the modern in the post-war period, in that the very idea of a domestic ideal, of a new domestic ideal in the post-war period was constructed in opposition to this kind of housing, which was seen as, you know, the unhomely, the unideal. And that's a term that I explore with reference to a very interesting series of fire safety displays that the LCC did at this exhibition called the Ideal Home Exhibition, which people may know because it's still running. Yeah, looking at these fire safety displays, you see how the subdivided terraced house, the private rented housing, particularly the multiple occupancy home, is constructed as the other to the homely ideals of the day. And they're these fascinating, quite disturbing exhibitions because on the one hand, they're about publicizing the terrible conditions in this kind of housing and putting pressure on landlords to deal with it as well as offering safety advice, but they're also incredibly fantastical and somewhat voyeuristic, and they hark back to images of the bomb site or the ruined buildings that littered London after the Second World War, with these kind of blown out interiors, these kind of dark, almost baroque spaces.
So you talk about how these rented rooms in post-war London were, or were certainly perceived to be, the setting of social problems. What kind of problems were they?
Yeah, they were seen as the places where all kinds of social problems kind of concentrated. So problems like the idea of delinquent youth and its links to so-called problem families. This is essentially a kind of pathologization of larger working class families, and it being linked to the rising kind of crime wave in the early 50s. Two particular problems I focus on, which almost seem like opposites in a way, but are connected in interesting ways, are the problem of isolation and loneliness on the one hand, and the problem of overcrowding on the other. You know, both of these, I mean, I think like all the so-called social problems of the post-war period that are seen to concentrate in private rented housing, these hark back to issues of the 19th century. And, you know, when we're talking about isolation, in a way, it's the kind of universal trope of atomization that, you know, big city living brings about. But these rented rooms become particularly perceived as problematic with the issue of overcrowding that I mentioned. I think what's interesting in the post-war period is this becomes racialized. It becomes linked to immigration. So you have in 1954 a pamphlet put out by the Commonwealth, the Conservative Commonwealth Association, which talks about a quote, new Harlem taking root in dilapidated areas of the inner city, where rooms in large dilapidated houses are sublet at high rentals, quote, to coloured immigrants in conditions of utmost squalor. I mean, the racist language is on the surface. It's not hidden. But what's interesting is at the same time, there's this strong desire from the government to, on the international stage, to hold the Commonwealth together. And of course, there's the open door immigration policy from the end of the Second World War to meet Britain's labour needs. So this tying of immigration to the housing crisis, I mean, an old tactic, well, a familiar tactic by now, but it could be said to originate then, is counterbalanced with other priorities. There's this attempt by the government in the mid-50s to link immigration to the housing crisis in a way that has become a now familiar trope, you know, with the hostile environment and the right to rent policy nowadays. But I think what's interesting in the post-war period is that race is kind of defined in terms of domestic culture, in terms of the way that people live in their homes and the different habits that people display. That is partly how otherness is constructed at this time. And that has to do with the kind of tarnishing or waning of certain older ideas of biological racism. And it's a kind of new cultural presentation of those ideas. So the space of the home becomes incredibly charged and racialized, really. And you see that in all kinds of novels and popular films at the time. I think a particularly fascinating example is the film Flame in the Streets, which was adapted from a play by Ted Willis called Hot Summer Night. And in many ways, it's quite a serious attempt to confront racism in British society. And it comes broadly from the left. But you have these fascinating shots of the main character wandering through a house that's let out in rooms in the darkened interior. But then as she enters into each room kind of reveals a whole world in itself, with a family living in there, with all kinds of activities going on, with music being played, with a baby being changed. It's an exoticization of the kind of life that was imagined unfolding in those rooms. I think it also turns the room into a whole world in which, you know, it actually, partly against its own wishes, reveals the ways that people really made a life in these rooms and adapted the space, using furniture, using partitions of their own to hold all kinds of activities that were essential to them.
I think that links to the next question of thinking about how, at the same time as being spaces of social problems, these rented rooms also became spaces of resistance.
Yeah, there is a tendency to see the building of social housing after the Second World War as if it was kind of a done deal, you know, I think what's really important to recognise is that the struggle for housing, the battle for homes, as one pamphlet at the time put it, was ongoing. It was a continuous contest. And that battle was really waged actually mostly in the private rented sector. The pressure came from there. And I mean, that makes sense, and that's where the most terrible housing conditions were. And I trace that resistance from the 1946 mass squatting movement, in which tens of thousands of people took over empty army bases, and in London took over luxury service flats and hotels in these mass occupations. From there to the early 60s with the eruption of the Rackman scandal around the slum landlord Peter Rackman, and the way that tenants' associations had been building up from the mid-50s, exposing landlords, winning reductions in rent. And particularly the key moment was the 1957 Rent Act and the resistance that was organised in response to that. And yeah, I guess what I'm partly interested in is just remembering that all this stuff happened, but also articulating the link between the institutions of the welfare state and these grassroots struggles.
So the final question is, do you see parallels between this history and the situation we see today with evictions on the rise and the experience of the pandemic in terms of overcrowding and other housing issues?
Yeah, I think there are some parallels, really. I mean, I guess this is, you know, a crisis moment that we're living through. I mean, it's not on the scale of the Second World War, but it's possibly the biggest kind of crisis since then. And it's drawn kind of nostalgic comparisons with that time, you know, with the evocation of the Blitz spirit and so on. But I think aside from that, those nostalgic comparisons, there are real ones, you know, because I think what this crisis has done is to show, you know, when the government says to shelter at home, you know, it shows what a home really is, which is a place of shelter that is essential to health. So it rather than something that's for profit. So it kind of exposes that. It reveals what a home is really worth or should be worth. The poor housing conditions and overcrowding that still persist today have been linked explicitly to increased rates of COVID. So those problems that were already there have been exacerbated by this pandemic, which has not been the kind of great leveler that some people talked about at the beginning, but the great exposer of issues that were already there. Although those changes, like the eviction ban, have been rolled back now, I don't think those lessons are so easily forgotten. And I think that's fascinating.
I really enjoyed that from Alistair, and it's interesting to get this kind of evocative sense of what living in London during and after the Second World War was like, the kind of effects of the Blitz in particular. I recently read The Girls of Slender Means, which is a book by Muriel Spark, which is set during the war in a kind of young lady's lodging house in Kensington. And that sense of the kind of deterioration of both the urban and the social fabric is something very evocative about that moment in time.
Absolutely. I think Alistair Azar does a really good job of highlighting what was such a prolific experience, but which has not really been talked about in architectural history as much, you know, the dominant narrative of the, you know, welfare state reconstruction, housing, building. So it's really interesting. And he also talks about film as a source. And your mention of that Muriel Spark book is really interesting.
So who's our last contributor today, Jess?
So last but not least is Anharad Davis, who talked to us about the Walworth Garden project and the work of the Matrix Group. Anharad, can you tell us a bit about the Walworth Garden building and how the Matrix Group became involved in the project?
So Walworth Garden is a community garden based in near the Elephant Castle, about half a mile away from there. And it was initially started as a community space in 1987. A group of residents came together to take over an abandoned lot that had a series of Victorian terraces on it. And the idea was that the council was going to extend an adjacent council estate, but they ran out of money. And so this group of residents, who also happened to be kind of active Labour members, kind of got three councillors on board with them and persuaded them to give over this space. And very quickly it changed from being kind of just a community garden into being a horticultural training centre that was meant to be aimed at getting local people, local young people, into employment through skills training. So a massively ambitious project for a community group to run. So they had funding from the Department of the Environment for two paid employees to kind of start the program off. And they employed two women, one outreach worker and one horticultural manager for the garden. And during the groundworks, which took about 6 months, so the site was kind of your typical boarded up, full of knotweed, full of needles had been used by the kind of, or not used by the community, for 5 years preceding the opening of the garden. So there was a huge amount of work to do. They were the only two women working on site during that time. And it was felt that maybe the next part of the project, which was to build the main building for the school, could give them an opportunity to do something differently. Blaise Cook, who was the horticultural manager, at the time was having a house in Acton renovated by a group of female tradeswomen who were part of the Women in the Manual Trades group, which is a kind of organisation that was set up in the mid-70s to support women in the manual trades. And so she approached them and asked for advice as to how or who might help if they wanted to run it as an all-female project. And Matrix came up as a suggestion.
You've described a bit about the sort of development of the project, but how did the design specifically and the build of the Woolworth Garden link to the broader politics in that area at the time around squatting and collective?
So the garden, if I give you a little bit of a picture of Woolworth, it's a really, really mixed typologies. It was, you have the kind of Woolworth Road on one side and then Kennington Road on the other side. So these big arterial roads. And originally in the Greater London Plan, there was going to be one of the kind of second ring road that was going to be built post-1945 would have actually obliterated where the garden was. It was a zoological garden in the 1830s. So this is kind of going back a bit further. So there's always been park space and a tradition of kind of horticulture in the area. But as, you know, the 19th century progressed, more and more housing was built there. And so you have, approaching the mid-1970s, if I'll quote a statistic that Christine Wall puts forward in her article called Sisterhood and Squatting in the 1970s, by 1971, there are 23,000 empty dwellings that are awaiting demolition across London. And so you have this huge amount of vacant homes. And so the two sites adjacent to Woolworth were taken over as squats. So that's the Pullins Estate and then St Agnes Place. And St Agnes Place was first squatted in 1975, and it's a whole street and had a hugely mixed community from all female houses to Rastafarian community to families living there. There's also kind of punk scene growing up around that area. And so on that specific street, you have, I think there are two female houses. And because the way the council treated these homes, they would tie them up for demolition. And in that process, they would rip out the services, they'd remove floors, they'd pour concrete down the drains. And so if you were someone who was going to occupy one of these spaces, you had to have a certain amount of skills, trades acumen to kind of take over the spaces. And simultaneous to this moment, the first women are being allowed to undertake training on the TOPS courses in the around 1975. So you get a growing a momentum with women's liberation movement, with women wanting to kind of go into manual trades, and also the establishment of a couple of trade schools, one in the Lambeth Women's Workshop, which is also another Matrix project or a project that a lot of Matrix members were associated with. And then there's also the Southwark Women's Workshop, which again offers skills training for women. And so you have these communities of women squatting, and it's a real mix of as to why people ended up in squats. I would say it's ranges from kind of radical politics to kind of poor provision of housing to looking for alternative ways to share childcare and collective living. So it's a real mix of needs. And Dawn, who was the outreach worker, was part of this community. She wasn't living directly in it, but she was part of it. And so a lot of the site, initial site labour for the first bit of the Matrix construction on site was done by women living in these squats, partly because it's a word of mouth situation. People were coming in as day labourers. I know that some of them were musicians, some of them were working as architects, and one was a head teacher in a local school. It was a real kind of hodgepodge of people. of women involved in the initial work on site.
So the Matrix archive, the sort of history of them as a group, is still being pieced together. But can you say something about the impact that Matrix have had and what you think we can learn through the history of the Matrix group?
For my personal kind of engagement with it at the Garden, it wasn't a visible part of their history. They had no idea that Matrix had built the building, and having learnt that, they are approaching the redevelopment of the site and the kind of next futures plans differently after that. In terms of a kind of wider context, I mean, often the problem with this type of history, and specifically, I guess, with the Matrix archive, it was a very dispersed practice. It had over 25 members over the years. People came and went. It wasn't as formalized as you might say, because they were trying to run something differently and they were running it as a cooperative. But it meant there was no one central archive. And that's similar in terms of the trades. Women often work as sole traders. They're not part of a larger organization. And so really it's about visibility and hearing people who've encountered the exhibition at the Barbican. They hadn't necessarily heard or come across Matrix before. With Woolworth, the project has a kind of split history. Matrix didn't complete the build. They were taken off the project halfway through. And it was actually taken over by two architects who were part of the Coin Street redevelopment cooperative. And they took on and finished the build. And I was interviewing John Lawler, who was one of those architects recently. And he, you know, they're all part of a similar network. He knows Benedict Fu, who is also part of the Matrix group and was a writer and involved with things in North Wales as well. Hopefully as well, the next year they're going to republish the book that Matrix published. It's called Matrix Making Space, Women and the Man-Made Environment. And that will, again, kind of continue the discourse. But across, a lot of the Matrix members also went on to work in the kind of academy. And so that peripheralization hasn't been so visible, but it's, say, for example, Joss, who curated the show at the Barbican, her project, the Disordinary Architecture Project, continues the work around race, discrimination, non-gendered spaces and non-binary spaces. It is a really fascinating, complex project. I guess what's notable about it is, all really for me is about this, is about visibility and different types of how we conduct historical research. And a lot of this, Woolworth is a real prime example of, it is an incredibly kind of stretched, in the best possible way, organization. It's a very classic community organization in that every member of staff is doing, you know, a variety of activities and roles. And there has never been the capacity for an archive to be really cared about or constructed. And I happen to kind of encounter it as a volunteer, and by asking and probing around whether they had any drawings or any documentation, that's where this research began. But it, you know, there was no capacity within the organization itself. And it essentially mirrors the Matrix archive in that there was no momentum to actually bring it together whilst it was happening, because it was just too much. It was beyond the capacity of the group. And unless you kind of extrapolate in the way that, say, John is doing it with pulling out these stories that are definitely usually untold, that seems like it's such an important and exciting time in architectural research for that kind of work.
I think the work of Matrix that Angharad had described there, the way that they were centered on providing for communities and thinking better about how to supply things that communities needed, you know, green spaces in the city in the aftermath of the pandemic and stuff, I think that all feels extremely relevant and useful to us today. I was lucky enough to go along to the show about the Matrix, the exhibition that was on at the Barbican. It's closed there now, but it will be open at Newcastle Contemporary Art until the 23rd of July. So if you're listening to this episode now and didn't get a chance to see it, it is on in Newcastle.
Which was a great exhibition, and it was fascinating talking to Angharad about that. There were so many more stories than we could possibly fit in to our short kind of 10-minute extract. And I hope that that is the beginning of a much more sort of detailed history of that group of practitioners, but also, like you've said, those themes of architects within the community and also the sort of feminist practices within architecture, which we covered in one of our earlier episodes.
I think we covered in our very first episode of this series, didn't we? We've come full circle. And yeah, if you're listening to this and you haven't had a chance to check out any of the other episodes in this series, this will be the eighth one, covering a really wide variety of periods, places, people, themes. And we should say that this podcast has been made possible by the SAHGB. And if you've enjoyed listening to it, then you should become a member and check out the events and all of the various stuff that the society has going on.
Absolutely.
We're hoping to be back with you sometime soon with another new set of episodes on new themes, new ideas. But as it is, thank you everyone so much for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you. And thanks to the Society for making this podcast possible. And hopefully, like you say, we'll be back soon.
And also should say thank you to Nathan and David of Front Ear Podcasts, who produced this series from top to bottom and have done a very generous and brilliant job of making us sound more coherent than we are in real life. So thank you to them.
Thank you. Yes, Front Ear Podcasts, you're amazing. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. This podcast has been produced by the Society of Architectural Historians of Great Britain, SAHGB. Established in 1956, we're the leading subject association for architectural history in the United Kingdom. Our educational mission is to promote architectural history inclusively to diverse audiences. Our mantra is all places, all periods, all welcome. We promote knowledge through learning, education, and research. We disseminate that knowledge through programming, content, and publications, and we advocate for the discipline and our members. To find out more about our work and to support our educational mission, please visit our website, sahgb.org.uk, or follow us at the SAHGB on Twitter or on Facebook. We are open to all. This podcast series has been created by Jessica Kelly, Matthew Lloyd Roberts, and Neil Sashore. The series is produced by Frontier. To find out more about them, visit frontierpodcasts.com.